When at last, on the second day, they crossed the river on the ferry and reached the edge of the great forests, even Bonnie was awed by the height and girth of the trees. "Oh, they're like pillars holding up the sky," she breathed, as she turned her camera upon them. The quality of the air and light changed as they left the dry savanna behind them and entered this humid and lush forest world. At first they followed the main highway with its mile-wide open verges. Then, after 50 miles, they turned off onto one of the new development roads freshly cut into the virgin forest. The deeper they journeyed into the forest, the closer the trees crowded the roadway, until at last their high branches met overhead and they were in a tunnel filled with dappled and greenish light. Even the bellow of the truck engines that passed them seemed muted, as though the trees were blanketing and absorbing the alien and offensive sound. The surface of the road had been corduroyed with logs laid side by side, and over this was spread a layer of flinty gravel to give the great trucks footing. "The returning ore trucks bring the gravel back from the quarries near the lakeshore," Captain Cajo explained. "If they did not, the road would become a bottomless swamp of mud. It rains almost every day here." Every mile or so there were gangs of hundreds of men and women working on the road, spreading gravel and laying new logs to hold the surface together. "Who are they?" Daniel asked. "Convicts," Cajo dismissed them lightly. "Instead of spending money keeping them locked up and fed, we let them work off their debt to society." "A lot of convicts for such a small country," Daniel pointed out. "You must have a lot of crime in your Burma."
"The Yuhali are a bunch of rogues, thieves and troublemakers," Cajo explained, and then shuddered as he looked beyond the toiling lines of prisoners to the impenetrable forest behind them. "I hate this place," he said with abrupt and unusual vehemence. "It is a dark and evil place, fit only for monkeys and their close relatives, the Bambuti pygmies."
"Shall we see any pygmies?" Bonnie demanded eagerly.
"Some of them tread on along the road, just the tame ones do," Cajo muttered. "And their women whore with the truck drivers, but the wild ones are forest animals. We won't see them. Nobody does."
He shuddered again.
"I hate this place. We should cut down all these trees and sell them, and plant grass pasture in their place so that our cattle can multiply."
It was spoken with the fierce Haita love of cattle, the tribe's greatest treasure.
"If the trees were gone, the rains would cease. Then the rivers that flow down to the lake and water your herds would dry up. All things in nature depend upon each other. If you destroy one, you damage all," Daniel began to explain. But Cajo snarled at him as he wrestled with the wheel of the Land Rover as it bounced over the corduroy of logs.
"It is not necessary to patronize me, Dr. Armstrong. I have a university degree, and strange as it may seem, I can actually read. I know all these white elitist theories that you and people like you propound. It is all very well for you rich white people to tell us to starve ourselves and our cattle herds, so that you can come here as tourists to stare for a few days at the beautiful view and admire the wild animals, then go home to your penthouses in New York and your mansions in England."
He broke off and drew a deep breath.
"Forgive me, Doctor, I did not mean to give offence, but we Africans have to live here. We also have a right to a good life. These trees that you admire so much belong to us. We have a rapidly expanding population to care for. Yubomo's population is growing by 6% every year. We need food and shelter and education, and we need land. Our people are crying out for land. These forests are useless to us unless we utilize them. We should cut them down and burn them and use the earth for gardens and pastures."
Daniel was saddened as he listened. Cajo was an educated and intelligent young man. If he still clung to the traditional view, what hope was there of convincing the unsophisticated country people like those that they had filmed in the Manyatas?
"Your white elitist theories," Cajo had said.
That was the viewpoint that could turn a continent into a desert. One day the Sahara might stretch from Cairo to the flat-topped mountain that guarded the Cape of Good Hope. So they came eventually to Sengi Sengi. The road ended at a considerable settlement in the midst of the forest. The larger trees had been left standing, but beneath them the undergrowth and lesser trees had been cleared to make way for the compounds that housed the labour force, for machine workshops and administrative buildings. The huts in the compound that housed the labour force
were made from materials gathered on the site. The walls were of raw timber, plastered with red clay, and the roofs were of thatch. The workshops and offices were prefabricated structures, constructed in sections so that they could be taken down and moved to a new site with little effort or expense. Keijo parked the Land Rover in front of the main office building, another temporary structure set on brick piers to allow air to circulate below the floorboards, and in that way to cool the interior and keep it dry during the daily rainstorms. He led them up the steps. "I must introduce you to the field manager of UDC."
"What does UDC stand for?" Bonnie wanted to know.
"Yobomo Development Corporation," Keijo replied, and would have gone on to explain further, but the manager's secretary looked up from her typewriter as they entered the reception area of the building. She was a Haiter girl in her mid-twenties, probably a graduate of the new technical college in Kahale, dressed in Western-style clothing and wearing lipstick and eyeshadow. Her appeal seemed incongruous after the natural beauties they had so recently filmed in the Manyatas.
"Oh, you must be the film people," she greeted them brightly in Swahili. "We have been expecting you."
"We were delayed," Keijo started to explain, but broke off as the door to the inner office opened and the field manager came out, smiling brightly. "Welcome to Sengi Sengi," he said as he came towards them. "You should have been here yesterday, but better late than never." Keijo was standing in front of Daniel, obscuring him for the moment with his 6'6" height. Now he moved aside, and Daniel and the field manager confronted each other.
"Mr. Chedi Singh," Daniel said softly, "I never expected to see you again. What a great pleasure this is." The bearded Sikh stopped as though he had walked into a glass wall and stared at Daniel.
"You know each other?" Captain Keijo asked. "What a happy coincidence."
"We are old friends," Daniel replied. "We share a common interest in wildlife, especially elephants and leopards." He was smiling as he extended his hand to Chetty Singh. "How are you, Mr. Singh? The last time we met, you had suffered a little accident, hadn't you?"
Chetty Singh had turned a ghastly ashen colour beneath his dark complexion, but with an obvious effort he rallied from the shock. For a moment his eyes blazed, and Daniel thought he might attack him. Then he accepted Daniel's pretense of friendliness and tried to smile, but it was like an animal baring its teeth. He reached out to accept Daniel's proffered handshake, but he used his left hand. His right sleeve was empty, folded back and pinned upon itself. The blunt outline of the stump showed through the striped cotton. Daniel saw that the amputation was below the elbow. It was a typical mauling injury. The leopard would have chewed the bone into fragments that no surgeon could knit together again. Although there were no scars or other injuries apparent at a glance, Chetty Singh's once portly body had been stripped of every ounce of superfluous fat and flesh. He was thin as an AIDS victim, and the whites of his eyes had an unhealthy yellowish tinge. It was obvious that he had been through a bad time, and that he was not yet fully recovered. His beard was still thick and glossy, curled up under his chin, the ends tucked into his spotless white turban.
"Indeed, what an absolute pleasure to see you again, Doctor."
His eyes gave the lie to the words.
Thank you for your kind sympathy, but happily I'm fully recovered, except for my missing appendage." He wiggled the stump. "It is a nuisance, but I expect to receive full compensation for my loss from those responsible, never mind."
His touch was cool as a lizard's skin, but he withdrew his hand from Daniel's and turned to Bonnie and Keijo. His smile became more natural and he greeted them cordially. When he turned back to Daniel, he was no longer smiling.
"And so, Doctor, you have come to make us all famous with your television show. We shall all be film stars."
He was watching Daniel's face with a strange, greedy expression, like a python looking at a hare. The shock of meeting had been almost as great to Daniel as it had obviously been to the Sikh. Of course, Mike Hargreave had told him that Chetty Singh had survived the leopard attack, but that had been months ago, and he had never expected Chetty Singh to turn up here in Yobomo, thousands of miles from where he had last seen him. Then, when he thought about it, he realised that he should really have been prepared for this. There was a strong link between Ning Chenggong and the Sikh. If Ning were placed in charge in Yobomo,
he would naturally appoint as his assistant somebody who knew every wrinkle of the local terrain and who had his networks securely in place. In retrospect, it was obvious that Chetty Singh had been the perfect choice for Ning. The Sikhs' organization had infiltrated every country in Central Africa. He had agents in the field. He knew whom to bribe and whom to intimidate. But most of all, he was totally unscrupulous and bound to Ning Cheng Gong in loyalty and fear and greed. Daniel should have expected Chetty Singh to be lurking in Ning's shadow, should have been prepared to face his vengeance. It did not need the expression in Chetty Singh's eyes to warn him that he was in mortal danger. The only escape from Sengi Sengi was along the single roadway through the forest, every mile of which was controlled by company guards and numerous military roadblocks. Chetty Singh was going to try to kill him. There could not be a single doubt of that. He had no weapon nor any other form of defence. Chetty Singh commanded the ground and could choose the time and the place to do it. Chetty Singh had turned back and was chatting to Captain Cajo and Bonnie. "It is too late to already for me to offer to show you around. It will be dark in a short while. You will want to move into the quarters we have prepared for you." He paused and beamed at them genially. "Besides which, I have exciting news for you. I have just this minute received a fax from Government House in Kaali. President Tafari, in the very flesh, is coming to Sengi Sengi by helicopter. He will arrive tomorrow morning, and he has most graciously consented to a film interview on the site of our operation here. It is a great honour, I assure you. President Tafari is not a man to be taken lightly, and he will be accompanied by the Chief Executive Officer of UDC, none other than our own Mr. Ning Cheng Gong. He is another eminently important personage. Perhaps he will also consent to play a part in your production." It was raining again as Chetty Singh's secretary showed them to the quarters that had been set aside for them. The rain rattled like birdshot on the roofs of the buildings, and the already saturated earth steamed with a mist that was blue as smoke in the twilight beneath the forest canopy. Wooden catwalks had been laid between the buildings, and the secretary provided them with cheap plastic umbrellas gaudily emblazoned with the slogan, "UDC means a better life for all." The guest quarters were a row of small rooms like stables in a long Nissen hut. Each room contained rudimentary furniture, bed, chair, cupboard, desk, etc. There was a communal washroom and lavatory in the centre of the long hut. Daniel checked his own room carefully. The door had a lock that was so flimsy that it would yield to any determined pressure, besides which Chetty Singh certainly had a duplicate key. The window was covered by a mosquito screen, and there was a mosquito net hanging above the bed, none of which was any protection. The walls were so thin that he could hear Cajo moving around in the room beside his. It was going to be a pleasant stay. "Okay, folks, we'll have a competition," he grinned ruefully to himself. "Guess when Chetty Singh will make his first attempt to bump us off. First prize is a week's holiday at Sengi Sengi. Second prize is 2 weeks' holiday at Sengi Sengi." Dinner was served in the mess for senior staff. It was another Nissen hut, comfortably furnished as a bar and canteen. When Daniel and Bonnie entered, there was a mixed bag of Taiwanese and British engineers and technicians filling the mess with cigarette smoke and noisy chatter. Nobody took much notice of him, but Bonnie caused a mild sensation, as usual, especially with the group of Brits playing darts and drinking lager at the bar. The Taiwanese seemed to be keeping to themselves, and Daniel sensed a tension between the two groups. This was confirmed when one of the British engineers told Daniel that since Ning had taken over UDC, he had been ousting the British engineers and managers and replacing them with his own Taiwanese. Bonnie was instantly adopted by the British contingent, and after dinner, Daniel left her playing darts with a couple of beefy mining engineers. She intercepted Daniel heading for the door, and she grinned at him maliciously as she whispered, "Enjoy your lonely bed, lover." He grinned back at her as icily, "I never did like a crowd." As he made his way through the darkness along the slippery mud-cake catwalk, a spot in the centre of his back itched. It was the spot into which somebody sneaking up behind him might stick a knife. He quickened his pace. When he reached the door of his room in the Nissen hut, he pushed it open but hung back for a minute,
There could be somebody waiting for him in the darkened room. He gave them a chance to move before he slipped his arm around the door frame and switched on the overhead light. Only then did he venture in cautiously. He locked the flimsy door and drew the curtains and sat on the bed to unlace his boots. There were just too many ways that Chetty Singh could choose to do it. He knew he couldn't guard against them all. At that moment, he felt something move under the bedclothes on which he was sitting. It was a slow, stealthy, reptilian sliding movement beneath the thin sheet, and it touched his thigh. An icy dart of fear shot up his spine, stiffening every muscle in his body. He had always had an unreasoning fear of snakes. One of his earliest memories was of a cobra in his nursery. It had only been a few months after his fourth birthday, but he vividly remembered the grotesque shadow that the reptile's extended hood had thrown upon the nursery wall as it reared in the diffuse beam of the nightlight that his mother had placed beside his bed. He remembered the explosive hisses with which the snake had challenged his own wild and terrified screams before his father had burst into the nursery in his pyjamas. Now he knew with the utmost certainty that the thing beneath the sheet was a snake. He knew that Chetty Singh, or one of his men, had placed it there. It must be one of the more deadly species, one of the mambas, slim and glittering, with their thin grinning lips, or a forest cobra, black as death, or one of the thick, repulsive gaboon adders. Daniel sprang from the bed and spun around to face it. His heart hammered wildly as he looked around for a weapon. He snatched up the flimsy chair and, with the strength of his fear, tore off one of the legs. With this weapon in his hand, he regained control of himself. He was still breathing rapidly, and he experienced a quick rush of shame. As a game ranger, he had stood down the determined charges of buffalo and elephant and the great killer cats. As a soldier, he had parachuted into enemy territory and fought it out in hand-to-hand combat, but now he was panting and shaking at a phantom of his imagination. He steeled himself to go back to the bed. With his left hand, he took the corner of the sheet, raised the chair leg with the other hand, and flung back the bedclothes. A striped forest mouse sat in the centre of the white sheet. It had long white whiskers, and its bright inquisitive button eyes blinked rapidly in the sudden light. Daniel was barely able to arrest the blow that he had already launched at it, and he and the tiny creature stared at each other in astonishment. Then his shoulders sagged and shook with nervous laughter. The mouse squeaked and leapt off the bed. It darted across the floor and vanished into a hole in the wainscoting, and Daniel collapsed onto the bed and doubled up with laughter. "Oh, my God, Chetty Singh," he gasped. "You won't stop at anything, will you? What other nefarious tricks have you got up your sleeve?"